Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. It was Joseph Heller in Catch 22 who gave us the well-worn aphorism, just because you're paranoid, it doesn't mean they're not out to get you. Guarding our personal mental equilibrium has never been easy, and it's not getting any easier. I've always tried to keep my mind out of the reach of conspiracy theories, which all have the potential to destabilize and allow fear and anxiety to cloud our judgment. And that's one side of the position. The other side is the ostrich and its head comfortably buried in the protective sand, as if there's a complete disconnect between what we perceive and what's actually happening around us, which there isn't. The 20th century was a century of collectivism and the emergence of the secular state. In totalitarian states, it became immediately clear the state had ambitions to replace the family and set out to irrevocably change the balance of power between them. In the West, the 21st century is becoming an age of soft totalitarianism. In a more subtle but no less ambitious way, the state has pursued legislative and social policies that have steadily removed the protection of the family and its private ideologies, whilst creating its own ethical climate and environment, and no more so than in the undermining of heterosexuality with a shared priority of men and women having children together. In recent decades, a new development has emerged, foretold by some, but nonetheless shocking and nonetheless harrowing, the intentional sexualization of children. Intentional is the important word here. It could easily have been thought to be the consequence of a hedonistic society, a vehicle slipping slowly downhill, gathering pace before it crashes. Except that Kimberly Ells, a mother and housewife, found herself looking at the United Nations policy documents and began to trace a trajectory of mutual interest between Planned Parenthood, the abortion provider, and United Nations policy development. To put it at its bluntest and simplest, Planned Parenthood makes profits from abortions. The more abortions, the bigger the company, the bigger its influence, the bigger its profits. Is it conceivable that the sexualization of children constitutes something amounting to a business plan? Kids have sex. Kids are not the most responsible people in the world. Kids get pregnant. Kids have abortions. QED. Kimberly Ells wrote a book called The Invincible Family to chart this struggle between the family and the state. And she joins me now. Kimberly, it's a very great pleasure to meet you online. I've watched you. I've read your book. I've been very impressed. And I'm so glad you're willing to take time to talk to us here, because everyone gives lip service to the importance of the family and everyone recognizes that the state is not family friendly, and there's a competition between the Christian view of family and the left and progressive view of communitarianism. But few people have articulated as clearly as you have. And I wonder if we can't begin, if you don't mind, by just telling people where and when it was you decided you had to go looking into this yourself.
Sure. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you today. I kind of dove into this fight about 10 years ago when I was exposed online to some information about the Children's Sexual Rights Campaign. And I found a document that troubled me a lot, talking about the fact that children have sexual rights that the government needs to protect and fulfill. And I'm the mother of 5 children. And so, as you can imagine, that upset me. I don't believe that there is such a thing as children's sexual rights and that children should be sexualized. So that kind of lit a fire under me. And then also, just as a mother, I began to understand more deeply the function of the family, the function of the mother. And in process of all of that and being exposed to the children's sexual rights movement, I joined with another organization that was already working at the global level on these issues. And so then over the past 10 years, I've had experience at the United Nations helping to fight for the family, observing what's happening there. And it's quite dire. And so that's kind of where the book came from, is that I realized that I needed to speak about these issues and I needed to expose what was happening at the global level and explain how we can fight back and how we must and how we can as families.
This is very helpful. And I think just to try and cross the Atlantic divide for a moment, the context that we're in is that in the 1970s, the whole gay rights movement appeared to have a paedophile wing to it. And so a number of left-wing politicians incautiously talked about lowering the age of consent. And then when society paid attention to them, they said, oops, well, we misspoke. We didn't really mean that. We're not really paedophiles. But many of us suspected they were and that they were simply hiding their original intentions. And
One of the things that's been clear as we've found the progressive agenda starting was that after feminism, there would come gay rights, and we didn't see the trans lobby coming out in the way it has done. But it was pretty clear that the sexualization of children would be arriving at some point in this, if you like, these carriages of the progressive train that have burst through. And then it's been astonishing the speed with which they've come. So look, go back to your United Nations work, because again, some people are going to think that we may be over-conspiratorially minded. But in your work at the United Nations, what you're saying is you've discovered an agenda. We could call it a plot or a plan, but let's call it an agenda for the moment. And the agenda involves the sexualization of children. Can you unwrap that a little bit?
Yes, it absolutely does. And I was hesitant, you know, when I ran across that document, I thought, is this even real? Who would be suggesting that there are sexual rights for children that need to be celebrated and protected, meaning that children have a right to experience sexual activity and sexual pleasure and have access to sexual information? That's the crux of what they're saying, and to have, quote, sexual services. I found that incredible. And so when I went to the United Nations and saw for myself, kind of the scales fell away from my eyes, and it was no longer a conspiracy. It was what I was seeing. And there's very much a strong anti-family sentiment at the United Nations. Almost every event that I've gone to at the Commission on the Status of Women every year in the spring is based on the idea of sexual rights. Many of them are referred to adult women, which I don't even necessarily believe with that in that concept, but many of them are aimed at youth. It's very clear. And when you read their documents, for instance, this is a quote from one of the documents, that original document that I found. It says, "Sexuality and sexual pleasure are important parts of being human for everyone, no matter what age, no matter what, if you're married or not, and no matter if you want to have children or not." And then it goes on to say that governments and leaders have a duty to protect and fulfill all sexual rights for everyone. That's very clear. There's nothing hidden there. It said at all ages. You can see this is carried out on a global level. And the United Nations documents on sexuality for children themselves, which you can find incidentally at a website called stopcse.org, that stands for stopsexualityeducation.org, you can see that the UN documents are very clear, advocating for sexual activity for children and encouraging self-exploration for children sexually. That's disturbing. Most parents are not on board with that. Most just logical, normal people see that that's problematic, to be pointing our children towards sex at an early age. It's very troubling to see. And then, of course, the United Nations gets money from essentially all the nations of the world. So they have this massive budget to push forward from the top down a very anti-family, pro-sex for children agenda. And if you just go looking even a little bit, it's not very hidden.
One of the things you do in the book, too, is you expose or you document the political and theoretical history. And so for a lot of my generation, being on the left was seen as very virtuous because the right was associated with people who had all the stuff, who used to control society, who really messed up in the 20th century and produced some dreadful wars. And the left was full of ideologues who believed in being kind to the downtrodden and producing justice where there wasn't any, and democracy where it was required. And so the left had a serious moral capital advantage over even the center, but certainly the right. But one of the things that's become clear to anyone who's done a bit more serious reading, and you make it very clear in your book and so helpfully, is that the left had an anti-family agenda in the first place, because there are only two communities available in this fight. There's either the collectivist communitarian model, in which families get in the way, or there's parents and children and small communities, and if you like, a kind of nano-collectivism, which is either the village or the town, but at the most the country. But the left doesn't like even countries. They have too much accountability and solidarity. So one of the things you've done is to look at the original socialist theory and say, they were going to do this all the way along. This is part of the project.
Exactly. And what we have to do is we have to look at even go back farther to the creation of the world. And whether you believe that that was enacted by God or by evolution, it still stands. So the way that babies are born, it requires the cooperation of a man and a woman together. And then what happens? Then a baby is born to who? The mother. And that's significant. We kind of take it for granted. But what that does is it ensures that every person who's ever born is claimed by someone. And that someone is always a woman. Most women, after they've given birth, tend to believe that the baby that they've carried and birthed is theirs, that it belongs to them, and that they belong to their child. And so that's absolutely fundamental, because that's where the whole idea of privatization and private families comes from, is because a woman believes that her baby belongs to her. And the father that she's married to also believes that the baby belongs to her. And it does, because the baby was in fact part of the mother and father to begin with. They are in part them. And that does a couple of things. It helps to ensure that in most cases, love exists for the child, because we all generally tend to love ourselves at the level of self-preservation at least. And so if something was part of us, there's a greater likelihood that we're going to love and cherish it. And that's why we love and cherish our children. And then the other thing it does is, like I said, it establishes the family as a private institution, not a collective, not run by outside sources, but the mother and the father are essentially the governors of that small little government. And that government of the family existed before any other government ever did. I believe it will outlast any other government that ever, you know, may rise or fall. And so the idea that a baby belongs to its parents is absolutely fundamental. And that's actually in direct opposition to what the state, especially the state today, is aiming for. And as you mentioned, socialist ideology from the very beginning has framed the family as the enemy, specifically wanting to remove the mother from the care of her children. And the writings of Engels, and I go through this all in the book, but Friedrich Engels, the right-hand man of Karl Marx, wrote a whole book on this, explaining how we needed to, quote, free women from their own children so that they could engage in socially productive work. And if you look at that argument, he's saying that raising humanity, raising children, is not socially productive work. I would argue it's probably the most socially productive work that there is. But you see, it's very calculated, because if you convince the mother that her children might not even belong to her, it's more important that they belong to the state so that they can be raised up in the ways the state that wants them to be a good citizen, and that we need to convince her that she's oppressed somehow by her own children, that she needs to be freed from that position. Well, what does that do? That opens up an opportunity for the state to usurp the power that the mother and the family have to raise humanity. And that's exactly what they're after.
I had misunderstood, I think, the way in which men and fathers have been dispensed with, particularly in America, where we know that the number of absent fathers has reached epidemic proportions. And I had taken it really as part of the sexual revolution. Women were too generous in their sexual favors to men, and they offered them to men without any commitment. Men took them, mistakes were made, children got pregnant. There was an enormous abortion industry, which we'll come to in a minute, because it's part of the whole strategy we're talking about. But where children weren't aborted, nonetheless, there were absent fathers, because the fathers didn't marry the mother. And then the state stepped in with welfare, with what appeared to be an act of generosity. But effectively, the state began, before it ever replaces the mother in the way you've been discussing, it began by replacing the father, by taking the role of the father, by caring and providing financially, thereby making the father all but unnecessary, apart from emotionally or psychologically. And not many fathers were willing to put being accessible emotionally and psychologically at the top of their priority list. So suddenly we have no fathers. And this seems to be a two-stage thing. First of all, in the last 50 years, deprive families and children of their fathers and wives of their husbands. And then the next stage seems to be, as you have been saying, to replace the claims of motherhood with the claims of the state. And we see that happening now, particularly in sex education. I mean, sex education seems to me to be where, if you like, the tire hits the road. This is where the crunch comes. Mothers and fathers, where they're there, say, we don't want our children sexualized before adolescence by educationalists. And the state is saying, we're going to insist, in fact, we're even going to pass laws requiring you to allow your children to be sexualized. This seems to me to have only happened in the last 5 to 10 years. Is that your understanding of the strategy? Can you explain a little bit about how that developed? Is it only 5 to 10 years old? Was it always intended? Is there some kind of accidental evolution in all this as part of hedonism, mm-hmm. or is it part of a strategy of statist control that has seeped through left-wing governments and particularly through the United Nations?
As we've all witnessed, it has exploded in the past 5 years, but it has been a very long-term strategy. And when you even look back in the United Nations documents and the way that they've moved things inch by inch forward and in other global institutions and elsewhere, you can see that the destruction of the family has been the goal. Again, because they want the power that the family inherently has. And back to the writings of Marx and Engels, Engels specifically talks about how what his definition of love is sexual love, more like love of sex rather than love of people and love of his own children. And there's this idea in his writings framing the father as almost evil for wanting to know who his own children are. And he frames that as a very selfish act, that's why men, quote, invented marriage, is so that they could know who their children were and then selfishly bestow their riches only on their children. Well, that's not a selfish thing. For men to want to know who his children are and to help them physically and support them and emotionally in every other way, that's a good thing. That is a good thing. But socialist theory convinces men that that's a selfish and bad thing to want to track who your own children are. And that's what marriage itself has done. So when a baby's born, you almost always know who the mother is, unless there's been egg swapping. But it's more difficult sometimes to know who the father is. That's why the umbilical cord connects babies to mothers, and you know that that connection is real. What I say is that marriage is the umbilical cord that connects men to their children. Because if men have made a commitment to their wives to be sexually exclusive, then more often than not, the children that emerge from his wife's womb are his. And he has both claim on them and responsibility for them. And you know, that's the very thing that tends to make the best men, that invites men into their best role, their most meaningful role, their most satisfying experiences in life is family life. Not that mothers or fathers can't have experience and expertise beyond the family, but family life invites the man to be responsible for what is his and to provide and protect and be attentive. And that is a good thing. So if in socialism, we're trying to remove that, remove fathers from the situation, which leaves the mother in a difficult situation. Then the state, as you said, the state comes in to act like they're rescuing. But what happens is that they're usurping. We've become so accustomed to this, I think, over the past 50 years. And we've just become accustomed to putting our children in free public schooling and trusting that system, which in the past may have been trustworthy. But now, as we've seen exposed in the past few years, the school system is extremely untrustworthy and is taking our children ideologically against our consent.
And there's an incoherence in the state's approach to fatherhood, which makes you suggest that they're either incompetent or there's an ideology being worked out. And I think it's probably the second. In this country, there's an organization called Fathers for Justice. And this is fathers who, whether they've married the mother or whether they haven't, it doesn't make much difference, find that their rights of access to their child are very, very hard to implement, even where they have them legally, and that the state and the courts are very reluctant to give the father the same rights or similar rights to the mother. Also, we have this long and drawn-out rhetoric of equality when it comes to providing fatherhood with a platform of access to their biological children. The state won't play ball. It insists on, I mean, usually the mother and father have fallen out, which is tragic. But particularly when they've fallen out, you need an umpire. But the umpire needs to be in the interests of the child. And although they say they're in the interests of the child, the legal system in this country generally favours the mother, allowing the state to take the place of the father yet again. I mean, I suspect that something similar happens in the United States. Is that the case?
Yes, that is largely the case. And in some instances, if there's been abuse, you can understand why there might be a preference for the mother. But the fact is, fathers are equally a parent as the mother is. They are equal parents and partners. And as you pointed out, the breaking of part of any marriage is very tragic, and it's very momentous for the children involved, which is why you and I and so many others are striving to protect and celebrate and bring people back to marriage, because it truly is the best solution. Although it's never perfect, it's the best solution for children, for men, and for women, and therefore society.
And also, I mean, setting aside the left-right political spectrum, there's some very good reasons for being suspicious of the state. the state doesn't always do things well and efficiently and wisely collectively. And one of the things that struck me in your book that I was astonished at, and astonished that I hadn't seen it before, but I'd like you to articulate it, please, because you'll do a much better job. And that is that there's a connection between the abortion industry and the sexualization of children. If children are sexualized, and if we don't need Engels to legitimize it, but he did, and we can use him, but plenty of others have promoted pure hedonism, including, of course, the whole media culture. But if children are sexualized, of course, what happens is that they then can conceive children younger and younger. And when they conceive children, they may feel themselves under pressure not to keep them. And so they then get aborted. You were suggesting that the abortion industry is complicit in the sexualization of children because it suits their business plan. This was so horrific to me at so many levels. I can see immediately it might be the case, but could you try and justify your analysis for people for whom this is also a fresh idea?
Yes, and it becomes very obvious when you look at it through new eyes. So that original document that upset me so much, talking about sexual rights for children, telling the children that they need to engage in sexual acts, was published by International Planned Parenthood Federation. Now, Planned Parenthood, as we all know, their main moneymaker is abortion. They need to abort babies in order to enrich themselves. So how are you going to get more babies born so that you can abort them? You're going to get young people to have sex. And Planned Parenthood boasts of the fact that they are the largest provider of comprehensive sexuality education in our nation and perhaps in the world. And then if you look closely at their programs, they promote sex for children. They promote the formation of life in unideal circumstances. Yes, they promote birth control and other things. No, I believe knowing that that is definitely not 100% effective, especially when you're dealing with teenagers, knowing that they're leading young people into a situation of crisis, particularly girls, where they're going to then feel, quote, that they need an abortion. And then who do these programs that are presented in the schools point the children to? Planned Parenthood. Even my own daughter, when she was in the eighth grade, came home from school very upset and told me that at the end of one of their presentations about sex and relationships, they had referred children to Planned Parenthood if they didn't feel that they could talk to their parents. And so if you see that they have all their ducks in a line.
Can you just translate eighth grade to an age? But what age is eighth grade?
Sure. Roughly 14.
Right. So the on the cusp of adolescence, yes.
Yes. And so it makes such perfect sense. And I was sickened when I realized that this is the business plan. Teach children to have sex, paint it in the terms of their sexual rights, make it sound like a noble and good thing that we're providing these rights, these sexual rights for children, when in actuality, what it does is drag them down into the depths of grotesque sexual experiences at an early age that they're not prepared for. It impregnates girls, which then leads them into their abortion clinics, which then enriches them. It's very insidious. I just, this is one of the reasons why I fight against this so vehemently, is because that business model is very disgusting. And another thing that's troubling is that International Planned Parenthood Federation regularly partners with United Nations agencies. I've seen this for myself. I've been to events sponsored by International Planned Parenthood Federation and say UNICEF or UNFPA or UNESCO. And so they are very much in cahoots with each other, support the sexual rights campaign and the sexualization of children. Again, couched in these wonderful terms, but when you look at the details, it's very ugly and it is not in the best interests of children.
My own journey of discovery hasn't been particularly easy, partly because although no, I never bought a T-shirt saying I'm a feminist too as a man. For some time now, for decades, men have seen themselves as feminists and even bought the T-shirts. And it's been really quite difficult to have reservations about the whole feminist project, once again, because most of the moral capital on the left is about supposedly fairness and equity. But when you discover a bit more about feminism, and in particular you look at its waves, and then you then begin to see in which the level of incoherence within it has caused the whole trans turf debate, and you see you're not dealing with a sane ideology, you're dealing with a series of anarchic and destructive political reactions. It's nonetheless quite difficult to persuade people there's something constitutionally wrong with feminism and anti-masculinism. Have you found that your exposing the business plan of Planned Parenthood has opened some people's eyes and allowed them to recalibrate their response to progressive political values in a way that would require a shock of some kind? Because I think for most people, it takes a shock. I mean, gay marriage didn't really do it. Nobody got really upset about the fact that children were being born to surrogates. And if ever it was a matter of human rights, one should have said, what about the right of the child to have access to its biological parents? Why, if you're talking in terms of gay rights, why do the rights of two adults who've made choices trump the life and the rights of a child who hasn't got any choices, if you really are favouring victimhood and the disadvantaged? That was never answered, and again, it suggested that the ideology wasn't coherent and watertight, something else was going on. But that didn't provide a shock. I think the trans issues may just be beginning to shock people out, but it's taking quite a lot of shocking and it's very slow. Have you found that your articulation of the business plan of Planned Parenthood and the deliberate sexualization of children has actually struck a chord with people who didn't know anything about it?
Yes, I hope so. The book has been well received. It's called The Invincible Family, and I have had many people reach out to me. You know, my core audience was not necessarily the hard left. It's very hard to convince people who don't want to be convinced of anything, of course, on either side. But people who have kind of been taken in by perhaps the noble elements of feminism and like you say, the seemingly compassionate pieces of socialism. That's what I think what I think has been helpful, where my arguments are helpful to illustrate to people that from the beginning, these ideologies are very anti-family, anti-child, anti-gender, and extremely anti-woman, and have not brought about, for the most part, good outcomes for women, men, or society. And so the thing is, usually when we get people to look at the evidence of the actual sexuality education programs, most parents and others are horrified at what they see. My concern is that we're seeing people become used to that now, especially with the trans issue. To many of us, it seems obvious that we should not be subjecting young children to life-altering surgeries. This seems horrific and obvious. And we're getting kind of from some angles a shoulder shrug. Well, it's their right. It's who they really are. When in fact, you know, there's no biological base. As you say, the ideologies are somewhat dissonant within themselves. There's no physical evidence or biological basis or scientific basis for any of it. And so that, I think, to a lot of people is waking them up, and they are beginning to see, you know what, I went along with the gay issue, but I hope that people are starting to see that the gay ideology and the transgender ideology are completely divergent.
Yeah.
They are not coherent. One, the same sex, you know, marriage argument was based on the fact that you need to honor how someone was born. And whether you believe that or not, that's the argument. But the argument for transgenderism makes the body the enemy, and saying that the way they were born was wrong. Someone's entire body is wrong and has to be radically revolutionized in surgical ways. And this, I think, is helping a lot of people to pause and to think about the road we're going down, and to see just the utter destruction that it's wreaking upon children, you know, and upon our society, when we now, about half of us, hopefully more, but, you know, a good section of the population do not now believe that men and women exist as biological realities.
It would have been very hard to predict this particular kind of self-fulfilling fantasy, even a few years ago. You do think that you called your book The Invincible Family. That's warning the reader that you think the family is going to beat the state. Tell me why you think the family is going to win and beat the state, given this ideological competition for power and influence that we find ourselves caught up in the middle of.
Right. And see, in the end, this is a hopeful message, because we are up against all these global forces. There's all these nefarious actors at work. There's billions of dollars being spent to crush the family. And it can all seem very hopeless and overwhelming, but it doesn't need to be, because we can win with the family. In fact, I believe God has designed the family through anatomy to win, to triumph, because the family is the thing that always rises again. Where does new life come from? Nowhere but the family. Now, people are working on electric wombs, and that's another story for another day. But by and large, new life, babies come from a man and woman coming together in love and creating new life. And as I said, the family was founded before the state, and the family will outlast the state. Even if we, you know, keep shooting ourselves in the foot with all these false ideologies and harmful laws and things, and say things really do fall apart, the good news is the family is going to rise again because it's inherent in our anatomy. And I believe that's by design. And so two things. Ultimately, the family will just anatomically triumph again. And in our own families, although we can't protect our families from all outside forces and our children may not make every decision we want, we can make our homes fortresses against these ideologies. We can teach specifically and intentionally about sex, gender, marriage, and the family, and how these things are beautiful and God-given. And we can talk about how sex is a power to be exercised, not a right to exploit others for just for your own selfish gratification. And that sex produces families and then also helps to keep them together. So all these things need to be age appropriately, of course, talked about consistently in our families. And when we see a news article that's opposite of what we believe, we can bring that up. We can talk about it in our families. We can speak the truth, because for now, at least in our homes, we're still free to speak the truth. And so we need to do that. And we can. And most of the time, our children will listen.
And we're still free to buy books. And so can I suggest that people buy your book, The Invincible Family, by Kimberly Van Schaals. It's a great read. It's very informative. And although I've been in this area for some time, I learned such a lot from it. Kimberly, thank you so much for spending the time with us. Thank you for the conversation. We're really grateful.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.